too much debt on the part of too many countries. Well, once the pandemic happened, their incomes plummeted. And so many countries are at the brink. And there has to be some response. Now, initially, the G20, which is a group of countries that represented the vast majority of GDP income in the world, got together and said, we'll have a stay on payments, on debt payments, but only for the poorest countries, not the emerging markets, only for the official debt, that is government-to-government debt, not for private debt, not for multilateral debt. And now that the disease has continued for 10 months and it's likely to continue, especially in those countries, for months, months more, because they can't afford the vaccine, won't get it, they're at the back of the line. The problem is what was a temporary problem of inability to pay, now it is a real problem. There is a need for a debt restructuring. And unfortunately, we don't have a good framework for that debt restructuring.
Finally, if you can talk about the team that Biden is pulling together and those he hasn't named yet. You know, the man who says he will filibuster today, Senator Sanders, has been pushing hard to be named labor secretary. We don't know what that if that will happen. I'm wondering your thoughts on this. Also, you know, Janet Yellen, the new Treasury Secretary nominee, very well.
Yeah, she was my student the first year I taught at Yale. Back in 1967, she was a first-rate student. I knew she was going to make a real contribution, both academically and then as she has to policy. I actually think we need Bernie Sanders in the Senate. He's been the role he's playing right now in forcing, hopefully, the Senate to take up the issue of $2,000 help.
Would you endorse this filibuster today?
Yes, I think I think I would. You know, the point is that there will eventually the Senate will have to deal with it, and I think the refusal of McConnell to have democratic processes work, let people go on the record of what their view on this $2,000 seems to me part of the democratic process. There shouldn't be that much power in the majority leader in the Senate.
Joe Stiglitz, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Nobel Prize winning economist, Columbia University professor, chief economist for the Roosevelt Institute. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable group of people. Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriano Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. Wear a mask.
Indeed. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. Time for Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good overall, I guess. You know, better than last week. Once in a thousand year astronomical things that I missed. So I'm
right.
Okay. I'm good.
Yeah. Well, it's good that you were able to overcome that. You were really upset last week.
I was.
Our listeners, I know,
you only
feeling
heard,
your upset as well.
Yeah. Thank you. All the cards, letters, and a couple of telegrams that I don't know how they managed. People do care, or they're just interested.
And the attempts that people did try to move heaven and earth for you, that was really, really kind of people to try, but some of that was
a little
dangerous.
Very foolish.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Don't try and move heavenly bodies just to make someone else feel better.
Yeah, you know not what you're messing with.
Yeah.
Leave that to the universe.
Although it was nice of NASA to try and do that with the asteroid. But
normally those systems are to move asteroids away from the planet. I was impressed
that
they were able to repurpose that.
Although, after this year, I don't really care.
Yeah.
It can smack right into the planet.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
You should have said that to them when they called.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know. Monday morning quarterbacking. What are you going to do? Hey, this is our last show of the year. The last show of the year.
Good riddance.
Good riddance. Everybody says that. But you know what, Kyle? I got one thing to say to you. COVID-20. Yeah. Now, COVID-19 is what we're all upset about. That happened in 2019. What do you think 2020's got cooked up for us? Yeah, so be careful. Be careful how much you attack 2020, because it can still, you know, kick you in the ass a little bit more. COVID-20 might be a thing. Yeah, yeah.
I thought you were going to mention 6G, but okay.
No, I'm staying away from that.
Yeah.
And 5G and all the Gs. But no, it'll be good to move into at least a new number, a new phase, because this does seem to be a cursed year, and I think everybody will be happy to see it go and just start fresh, even though it's not going to really be starting fresh.
Well, the challenges of this year will be fresh in our memory, too, so I guess you bring it on. I mean, we'll be prepared. We'll basically do a lot of the same that we did last year in the face of COVID-20 or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever code name the next disease gets. But we're still suffering a disease in government.
Oh, we're going to go over there. Okay, yeah. Yeah, we are. For a little while longer. That's why you're hearing this theme.
It's not working for people.
No.
From what I hear.
No, it really isn't. On so many levels. And, well, I guess, you know, there's not much left.
Can you explain the whole Bernie Sanders thing? People are talking about that. He's apparently throwing down the gauntlet. Can you just give me the nutshell version?
I can try.
Bernie's going to save us.
Well, no. He's going to step up and kick some ass like he should have done and everybody should have done. I wish Democrats had done things like this. He's not a Democrat, you know, technically, but I just wish the Republicans hadn't gotten away with so much over the past however many years it's been. It's been more than 4 years. You know, when they're in the minority, they're able to stop things in their tracks. When they're in the majority, they're able to stop things in their tracks. It just seems like they always have the upper hand regardless. And when you look at the numbers as to what they actually represent, they are in a significant minority. And the only reason they hold on to power is because of outdated institutions like the Senate. The Senate is outdated because these are elected officials that represent land, not people. Think of two senators in South Dakota, two senators in North Dakota, four senators in a very sparsely populated part of the country that have double the representation of the two senators from California, you know? You can say, well, that's the way the founding fathers meant it. Yeah, but that's the way they meant it. There were a lot of things that didn't exist back then that exist now that have changed things dramatically. Our laws, our society has all changed a lot. The founding fathers cannot be responsible for everything that has happened ever since, and it's time for some changes. The Senate, that is one outdated institution. The Electoral College, of course, is the other. Again, representing land, not people, where you have a 7 million person majority or difference in the people who voted for Joe Biden versus the people who voted for Donald Trump. And to even consider for a second that, well, things have gone just a little bit differently with the Electoral College, we could have that kind of a gap and still Trump would have been the president. You know, people believe this. And actually, it's true because, yeah, if things had happened in a certain way, certain key votes had gone differently in certain states, then, yeah, that's exactly the scenario you would be looking at. And those states are more important than other states. New York is not important because New York goes a particular way. It's assumed that New York is going to go a particular way. So there's no real campaigning that happens in New York because New York doesn't count. If you're a Republican in New York, your vote doesn't count for president. How does that feel? You know, it's insane. Your vote should count just like anyone else's vote. But the way it works now, New York goes Democratic. The whole state goes Democratic. It's not the way a popular vote should go. And people say, well, it's not fair to have a popular vote because, well, then people in the cities are represented more than people in the country. Well, you know what? It's about people being represented. And by saying something like that, you're saying that people in the city on an individual basis do not count as much as people in the country. And that brings us back to the slavery days, because you're saying that some people are worth more than other people. And that's utter nonsense. I want to use a stronger word, but I can't. It's utter balderdash. I'll say that. That's what it is.
Or country values and lifestyles are more important or somehow valued more than the lifestyles and values of people that live in the cities. And I feel like there's an argument to be made for cities where you have proximity and populations and discourse accelerated and compressed in a lot of ways. Like if we're a melting pot as a whole, we have pressure cookers in the cities. I mean, people really learn a lot more about one another just by virtue of that proximity and volume. So to a degree, I think there's some judgments and some things that are learned a lot faster than the sort of slow pace of the country, like getting along or having immigration or cultural and other societal changes emerging are less jarring because people understand transformation. They understand that cities and places where people reside are subject to changes in the market, changes in the dynamics and the demographics. Mm-hmm. They're inevitable. They're happening. They've already happened in a lot of places. You want to be afraid of the city. You want to be afraid of integration or things from the city, the boogeyman that's going to come get you in the country. Guess what? They're already there.
Yeah.
And, it didn't work with the suburbs and the fear mongering in the election because that's already got people there. And they're coming for the country too. That and the hipsters, right? Like, it's to be so fearful is just so silly because a lot of what has been accelerated in this urban environments, it's applicable. You want to talk about broadband? Whatever the city's got wrong, guarantee they're going to get that wrong out in the country. And any number of other issues, food security or economic joblessness or job training, whatever, housing, these are all important issues. So I think there's actually insight that we might, maybe not on a legislative level, value more, but to critique the cities is not knowing or not knowing better. I think the cities ought to be careful of trying to come off and appear as though they know better, but they don't know any less than the country. And there's plenty of instructive things about that lifestyle too. Yes. Yeah, I just feel like there's a whole hour long distinction that we could get into there.
Well, I mean, what you say is what they will deny. It's not about fear or hostility towards the city, but that is exactly what it is. Because the assumption is that these people are not like us. All right, you know, maybe that's so, although that really isn't true, because if you spend time in cities, you'll find all kinds of people, all kinds of backgrounds. You'll learn so much, be exposed to so many different cultures and ways of living and history and things like that. But even if you believe that is so, does not give your minority of people the ultimate purity test to be able to make the decisions. It's wrong. It is racist. It is
it's entitlement,
anti-individual,
and it's a certain sort of entitlement.
It is an entitlement.
Like, oh, we're entitled to make the decisions and, for millions and millions of people, and you have no idea what it's like
to
live.
And you can
that.
Say it goes back to the founding fathers, but you know what? The founding fathers were a bunch of goddamn racists. I'm sorry, they were. Probably nice guys. Probably did the best they could with what they had, but they had their faults too, and they made their mistakes. And they lived in a different time. This is our time. This is 2020 and about to be 2021. Time to make some changes from 1776 and start actually representing who we are. And I want you to think about something. I want you to think about something. We are changing despite all the handicaps. Think about what has happened with things like gay marriage. Right? Think about what's happened with things like Black Lives Matter. This occurred while people were being oppressed, while Mitch McConnell was reigning supreme over everything. Yeah, we have changed. Confederate flags have been torn down. That happened under Trump. Trump was against it. It happened anyway. Republicans were running the country. It still happened. So it doesn't matter if they take control of everything using these antiquated institutions. The people still will speak and they still will change things in their own way. But imagine if the people actually had that level of power. And I think we're starting to get a taste of that right now. You asked about Bernie Sanders. What is Bernie Sanders going to be doing? Well, he has support from the Senate Democratic Caucus. And what he's going to be doing is using a series of procedural moves to delay that vote on the defense authorization bill, the one that I believe Trump vetoed. Now, the defense bill is going to become law. That can't be stopped. And I don't think they want to stop that, actually. But that's not the point. The bill is it's considered a must pass. That's how they refer to it. But what Mitch McConnell has done is refused to allow the motion to issue $2,000 checks to individuals, qualified individuals, to make up for all the crap that they have gone through under COVID-19. All the income lost, all the inconvenience, you know, something that other civilized countries have done for their people. Yeah, we had a $1,200 check? Back in the spring? Ask around in Europe. Ask around Canada. See what other countries have done for their citizens. And you'll find that this measly $600 that they finally agreed to after all this time was a slap in the face. And even Trump of all people saw this. Although he wasn't paying any attention. It was kind of pathetic and humorous at the same time. His own people negotiated this $600 travesty. And when he saw that, he said, this is too little. Yeah, no kidding. You finally crossed the finish line on that. So he, like a child, is insisting that nothing happened until the number gets changed. And of course, the Republicans are going berserk trying to figure out how to do this now because he agreed to one thing, changed his mind. Now he wants something else. But it just so happens that that's something else that he wants suits the Democrats and the citizens of the country, suits them fine. Yeah, $2,000. Let's make that happen. And so what happened over the weekend, they tried to have a unanimous consent vote in the House to just say, okay, let's go for $2,000. Republicans stopped that. That speaks volumes. Republicans just stopped it. They wouldn't allow unanimous consent, meaning at least one person objected, so they had to go to the formal, let's take a vote. And they did that yesterday. Guess what? It passed. It passed, actually. A bunch of Republicans jumped on board. Even Lee Zeldin jumped on board. But the only reason he jumped on board is because Trump told him to. That's true. So That's now passed, but it's going, it can go to the Senate. If it goes to the Senate, it passes. And everyone gets their $2,000 checks. But Mitch McConnell will not allow it to come to a vote. He has that kind of power. This alone is opening up so many eyes to what next Tuesday means in Georgia when the two Senate seats are voted upon. If those two Senate seats go Democrat, well, Mitch McConnell no longer has power. And something like this would go through. Even under Trump, it would go through because he wants it, but certainly under Biden, it would go through. So I think a lot of people are seeing, wow, this race really does make a difference. And from what we are hearing, millions of people have already voted, which is great. If you're in Georgia, I sure hope that you remember to vote. Vote early or vote next Tuesday. So what Bernie Sanders is doing now, since Mitch McConnell is being a dick and not allowing the $2,000 motion to come to a vote, he is going to delay that defense authorization bill from coming to a vote as well. He can't stop it. He doesn't really want to stop it. But by delaying it, kind of forces all the senators to stay there over New Year's. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, we were subjected to with Rand Paul time after time. Well, now a taste of your own medicine. You know, either act in the interest of people or prepare to be greatly inconvenienced. And I say it's about time. So, Sanders has a demand. He'll lift his objections to an immediate vote on the defense bill if McConnell permits a vote on legislation providing $2,000 checks to Americans earning less than $75,000 a year. Why is this so difficult? When you think of all the money that was given to billionaires in that disgusting tax cut a couple of years ago, it just blows my mind how people can quibble about what people who are barely getting by should get and shouldn't get. So what if they get a few extra dollars? Haven't we all earned something this past year just for getting through it? You know, it's year after year, the military asks for a certain budget. And repeatedly, our elected officials give them more than what they ask for. They give them things they don't want, because they want to be seen as supporting the military. It's disgusting. Mostly disgusting because in so doing, that money doesn't go to where it is really needed, in the hands of families and individuals and kids and schools and the environment. There's so many things I could just list for the next few hours. Things that are ignored. Because politicians just want to appear to be popular. I hope things are changing. So I hope that answers your question about what Bernie is up to.
Yes, it does.
You know, there was that vote. I mentioned it yesterday. Or I mentioned that the vote happened yesterday. And did you watch it on C-SPAN? They took a roll call, like they do.
Mm-hmm.
You might have noticed... that, like I said, a bunch of Republicans went over to the good side for a change and voted for the $2,000 checks. Two Democrats voted against it.
Really?
Did you know about that? Two Democrats voted against. What kind of rationale is that? So I waited for the listing to go up on the House website. And that was the only way you could find out who actually voted against it. And I found out who they were. Representative named Kurt Schrader from Oregon. And a representative named Dan Lipinski from Illinois. Now, Kurt Schrader from Oregon said the more generous payments risk giving money to people who don't need it. Yeah. That's his concern. He's, according to this this story from OPB.org. He has long been the most moderate Democrat in the state's congressional delegation. And Monday, he underlined that even more. He was one of just two Democrats to vote against a bill that would increase stimulus checks taxpayers will receive next year from $600 a person to $2,000. Schrader is a member of the moderate Blue Dog Democrats. He went further than a simple no vote. He took to the chamber floor to excoriate a bill he said was being pushed by extremists on both sides of the political spectrum. Those remarks and Schrader's vote have spurred withering responses from progressives on both the local and national stage. Schrader isn't concerned whether the working poor survive this pandemic or not, tweeted Milwaukee Mayor Mark Gamba, who lost a Democratic primary challenge to Schrader in this year. He has never represented the people of this district, and now it's clear to everyone. But Schrader, whose district touches the Portland suburbs and a long stretch of coastal and central Oregon, stood by his position today. We all live in a glass house here, but I do feel strongly that we shouldn't be making rash decisions based on tweets from an erratic president of the United States or different extremist groups that don't represent the mainstream of what I think America needs and wants. The congressman's central objection, he says, the stimulus package will offer relief to people who don't need it, when more focused programs targeting, say, childcare costs or helping employers pay workers would be better. Let's address those needs, he said. Let's not give them a one-time check that, frankly, is not targeted to those people with those needs. He raised a hypothetical case of a family with three children that makes $150,000 a year, which is the upper limit for receiving the full stimulus amount under the proposal, $75,000 times two. Since dependents qualify for payments, that family could receive $10,000 in payments, a prospect Schrader called ridiculous. Really? Ridiculous? A family of four getting $10,000 after living through a year of hell? You call that ridiculous? How long, Congressman, does it take you to make $10,000? I bet it's a lot quicker than that. And this guy is a Democrat. True, only one of two that did this. But, you know, even if you do take this objection seriously, what else is being offered right now? You would have to go back and start from scratch. And this has been going on for months, many months now. And this is what they have come up with. It took them this long. You want to go back to the beginning? You know, there are people out there starving. There are people out there losing their homes. And yeah, you might pay a few people a few dollars more than what they deserve. You're willing to blow it all up for that. You know, you would stop the defense bill if a couple of $500 toilet seats were uncovered or something that clearly was not right. No, you'd investigate what was wrong, and then you'd make sure all the money got to the places you want it to get to quickly.
I think we should use a parallel that we're all familiar with in the production of the vaccines. Before the efficacy results were in, a lot of the companies, now, albeit with some help from Operation Warp Speed and investment from the U.S. government, you know, or in the case of Pfizer, guaranteed sales of the vaccine through pre-ordering and so forth. But that aside, they invested in vaccines that were not yet proven, knowing they could lose the costs of development and the even up to and including the production facility. Why is this any different from the standpoint of political and economic health and well-being broader in a broader way across society this very particular socioeconomic class, namely the $75,000 and below. So essentially, and then of course you have on the lower end a lot of people who are already either on unemployment or getting other kinds of subsidized health or having assistance, financial assistance with other costs, food assistance, whatever it is. All of those things are there as a safety net. So here we are in this little in-between area giving an economic stimulus to, yes, people who may not necessarily need it, but why not bet on people to spend what you give them when really it's not about any one, from the perspective of the government, it's not about any one family surviving, it's about the entirety of the populace surviving and doing reasonably well. So if you stimulate the economy, you give people a baseline, whatever they do with it, needed or not, mm-hmm. you've put a baseline out there. And why not take the gamble, even if
exactly
it goes to places and it is not allocated, you know, surgically, mm-hmm. it's still in that range and it's still a bet for 2022, 2023, 2024, and on and on and on and
it's,
on and on.
Like you say, an investment. And that is what we should be giving to our citizens. We should be investing in them like we invest in the banks, like we invest in cars, you know, automobile industry, in all of that. In the military, we're constantly investing. Our citizens deserve no less.
And when you really do, when you run it, it's a little over a trillion, I think, or somewhere in there. I mean, and the original package that Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats put forth was a $4 trillion or $3.4 trillion mm-hmm. package. So to pay people this much money is, yes, substantial, but only slightly more than our defense budget.
Yeah, and reverse that tax cut, okay, for the billionaires. Reverse that and see how much money comes back.
Yeah, and or if those 200 million workers are destitute next year, mm-hmm. what is worth protecting? What are you protecting with the military if no one can eat?
Well, we're spending a lot of time criticizing this one guy, actually two guys. But just to close off with Kurt Schrader from Oregon. Oregon, what are you thinking? If you want a Republican, get a Republican. Although, you know, this guy, he has good positions on many other issues. But, for instance, gun control. I don't know. December 2017, he was one of only six House Democrats to support legislation allowing concealed handgun licensees to carry their weapons in all 50 states. He is one of the few Democrats to receive funding from the NRA. He was one of, again, six Democrats. Well, who are these six Democrats? Wow. In the House of Representatives to oppose a bill which would incrementally increase the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $15. But, okay, this pales in comparison to the other Democrat who voted against $2,000. And that was Representative Dan Lipinski from Illinois. I just want to read this letter that appeared in the Chicago Sun-Times today. And I guess, you know, when you publish online, you can quickly publish a letter to the editor when somebody does something that very day. It's called Good Riddance to Representative Dan Lipinski, a Democrat who was really a Republican. The people of the 3rd Congressional District have suffered for decades. Wow, decades, huh? By having U.S. Representative Dan Lipinski consistently vote Republican and for war expenditures over humane concerns. He betrayed his constituents and especially his blue-collar constituents who did not have the advantage of a daddy to hand them a job because his father held the position before him, as he did what has given him job security and all the perks of office like congressional health care. Lipinski, who lost his last election and is leaving office, was one of only two Democrats who voted on Monday against boosting COVID-19 benefit checks from $600 to $2,000 for eligible adults that would help save the unemployed and those desperately in need. Why? Good riddance to a Democrat who was really a Republican, signed Ed Julard from Morgan Park, Illinois. Let me look at some of his positions here. He did not endorse President Barack Obama for a re-election in 2012. He is anti-abortion, serves as co-chair of the bipartisan Congressional Pro-Life Caucus. He voted against legislation to increase funding for embryonic stem cell research. He was the only Illinois Democrat in Congress to oppose Obamacare. He was one of, again, only six Democratic members of the House to vote against the decriminalization of marijuana. He opposed same-sex marriage. Well, how is this guy a Democrat? How in God, and why does he keep getting reelected? But the good news is that he wasn't reelected this year. He lost in the primary, and a more progressive Democrat took his place. So there, we're changing. We're fixing things. I just don't know how this guy could have survived so long and called himself a Democrat.
Well, it's the constituency of wherever his the constituency he's representing probably is one way or the other, and creates a certain pressure to appeal as a like uber moderate. So far, moderate, you're pretty much on the other side there. Interesting stuff, though. It's important to know these down ballot races, and here they are, front and center.
Absolutely.
Affecting everything.
Definitely. Pay attention, folks. It matters. It really matters. It's really getting interesting. And as the year draws to a close, the drama is going to be increased quite a bit. But now, it's time for our sustaining feature, which for some reason isn't playing, because I pressed the wrong button. I'm sorry. Let me try that again. Now... I actually pressed the right button. It was unplugged. This is our sustaining feature, Films of the Year That Was, where Kyle and I journey back into time. And what else would you journey back into? See Academy Award-winning films year by year. And we're up to 1988. We see two films each time, foreign and domestic. Which one are we going to start with?
Rain Man.
So the question was, which one, domestic?
Yes, domestic. Right.
And the film is Rain Man.
Rain Man.
What a film! What an amazing film Rain Man was, right?
Yes.
You had never seen it before.
I'd seen pieces of it, but I hadn't seen it all the way through. And in fact, I had a composite of a couple other films in my head. I had it confused with, like, Scent of a Woman and What About Bob?
Uh-huh.
Which it kind of was a cross between, if you look at it in a certain way, but... That's not the point. The point is, I saw it and remembered it as something totally different, and it stars Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise.
Yeah, and you know, I'm as surprised as anybody to hear me say that one of the greatest films I've ever seen stars Tom Cruise. But he wasn't nominated for an Oscar for his role, and Dustin Hoffman was, and he won, and he deserved it because he played the role so incredibly. The role of Tom Cruise's autistic brother that he didn't know he had, he was in an institution. If you have ever had a relationship with somebody who is autistic, or if you've known autistic people or had conversations, his portrayal was spot on. He obviously did his research, it just was something that was so authentic. And this film has really opened up so many eyes in that world where people might not know anything else about autistic people, but they can say, I saw Rain Man. And okay, that's something. They've opened the door a little bit, and they can see how people think differently, how they act differently. And with that, we learn so much about ourselves, about our world. And I just, you know, seeing that film, it left me feeling good, you know, about humanity, about relationships. Tom Cruise was annoying as hell. He played the role well. I think he wasn't acting all that much, but you know, seeing him constantly not getting it, eventually getting it, of course, but just that whole period where he was just being a jerk. It was painful, but well done.
Yeah, and the director. Barry Morrow, or I'm sorry, the screenplay author Barry Morrow had created the character Raymond, who's the lead, playing the autistic lead, after meeting Kim Peek, a real life savant.
Uh-huh.
His characterization was based on both Peek and Bill Sactor, a good friend of Morrow's, who was the subject of Bill, an earlier film that Morrow wrote. So he had developed this story and even had another film based on it that he eventually pulled the character in and made a composite that told this story, which is of essentially a Tom Cruise, Charlie Babbitt character who's just really in this... fast-paced world. The Wikipedia describes him as a wheeler dealer, and his estranged father dies and leaves his fortune to his brother, who he does not realize it even existed, but only leaves him with, I believe it's a car and some rose bushes. So the hilarity ensues because Tom Cruise is so hell-bent on how his dad did him, you know, over an estate, and all he got was this prized possession and some stupid plants. Mm-hmm. And it just shows some of the rivalry and the family dynamics, but also that this was a way of him from beyond the grave showing him both a side of his life and a side of life that is actually outside of what he
was. His dad was trying to show him anything. I think his dad was as big a dick as Tom Cruise was.
Well, this,
Tom Cruise just did a lot of investigating and discovered this and through a happenstance managed to learn something and develop as a person.
I guess I'm reading, that's the reading too into it, mm-hmm. too much into it. They probably weren't that intentional, but that's kind of what it's trying to drive home, I think, is that, or if I was to glean like some kind of a moral or a lesson in it is that, that, you know, it really isn't so much about the estate or what you got materially. It's about this relationship and what you learn more and experience more of your family.
Right. Right.
In your father dying or something.
It was kind of cool though, because we have seen so many Academy Award winning films, domestic ones, that have been taking place in foreign lands and different cultures. We've seen Out of Africa. We've seen The Last Emperor. We've seen Gandhi. We've seen Platoon, Vietnam, China, Kenya, and India. So it was kind of nice to go back to contemporary American culture for a change, and this being the late 1980s, and also having a cross-country trip, because that is, of course, what happens. Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman drive all the way across country from Cincinnati to Los Angeles. And of course, he's trying to get, Tom Cruise's name is Charlie, I believe. Charlie's trying to get Raymond to fly on an airplane. And of course, that's one of the big scenes where Raymond absolutely refuses to do that and throws a big fit in the airport. And they wind up taking a car instead. And one of the classic lines to come out of that is the statement that Qantas has never crashed. Not entirely true. Qantas has crashed, but not when they had jets, back when they had propellers. They had a couple of crashes, but everybody did back then. So that's something. They didn't show this that particular scene on any airline for movies except Qantas. They proudly showed that scene. So that's kind of interesting right there. But I enjoyed seeing a lot of American culture going by, and it was all presented in a very positive way. Like, if you recall the scene where Raymond was trying to cross a street, and I guess for the first time he saw a sign flashing "Don't walk," and he just stopped in the middle of the street because he was obeying the sign saying "Don't walk." And this guy driving a pickup truck with a cowboy hat gets out and starts yelling at him, and just then that's when Tom Cruise, who's been looking for him, runs and finds him. That could have been a very hostile scene, and considering Tom Cruise's character as being, you know, a jerk, I'm surprised it didn't wind up that way. Instead, it was people treated each other with somewhat of respect. I'm sorry, he's troubled, and et cetera, et cetera, and people didn't resort to blows or anything like that. Another time in the casino, where Raymond is card counting because, hey, he's a savant and he can do this. And the head of security for Caesar's Palace calls them on it and says, okay, you guys leave the state. That's the best offer you're going to get. You know, no violence, nothing like that. Just, okay, well done. Now get out of here. And again, you know, kind of a positive way of dealing with a potentially negative situation. I think that might sort of outline the entire film.
Yeah, I think it was a six-card suite when you have six decks at a table.
I don't know how people can do that.
They said it's impossible to count a six-deck suite.
But
so
these things are possible.
He was doing that, and this was all to get money back so that Tom Cruise could get the Lamborghinis out of EPA
customs
clearance.
Yeah, that's a stupid story. That part of the story was dumb.
That's the premise of him needing all the money, mm-hmm. and being upset at his father, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, but there are people who can actually multiply, you know, five-digit numbers by other five-digit numbers and get the answer in a second. That is true. Or it can memorize phone books or things like that. It tells you what the human brain is capable of. And I just thought that was really fascinating. Another scene that just came to mind, where Raymond has a routine. And if some autistic people, they have these routines and they get very upset if the routines are broken, and watching People's Court at a certain time is part of his routine. Didn't make any sense. It was on the same time, no matter when they were, where they were in the country. It was a syndicated show, but I won't get into that. But they just knock on this farmhouse door with all these kids who, by the way, all those kids actually lived in that farmhouse. The mother that they hired was an actress, but they actually let these two strangers come into their house and watch a half hour TV program so that Raymond wouldn't throw a fit. So that's another act of kindness. There were a lot of acts of kindness. And I just thought that was, it's like what we need more of. We need to remind ourselves that that is who we really are. And I think to this day, we remain people who do things like that.
I think these also take you out of the normal roles and the normal behaviors we kind of come to expect in our interactions in society, and you create this opening for maybe perhaps more understanding and kindness, because to navigate someone who maybe doesn't communicate or is like non-standard in their being, it's important to give time to understand and to be empathetic to their needs and look for other signs and codes,
right,
to understand what they're focused on or what they're fearful of or what may be going on. And your reading of the situation is at a different level, and you need to adjust or recalibrate as such. And I think more of these, the other thing I want to mention just briefly is that we're seeing more and more of these stories. I know there was a program on TNT that had a character who was autistic.
Claus.
Yeah. Didi's brother.
I think it's TBS, but
was it TBS?
It's one of those.
Yeah, Desna, the main character's brother, is autistic.
Well, there are so many autistic people, and they really do contribute a lot to society. And it was just good to see that recognized, you know, and just that recognition. Just that is how it is. And not having this sugar sweet ending where everybody is all emotional. No, that's not how it goes. In the end, I'll ruin it. I'll ruin it. If you haven't seen the film, I'm just going to talk about how it ends, where Raymond is leaving on a train with somebody else. He doesn't look up. He doesn't wave. He's watching his TV program. He's intent on that. That is what he wants to do at that time. And that's his life. He's happy with that. All right. The foreign film.
Yes. So the 1987, we're at 88.
It
was filmed in 87, yeah. Won in 88.
It was conceived in 82.
Pell the Conqueror. Pell Aerobrerin.
I think you pronounce it Pella. Pella. No, it's not Pella. Pella, I think it is.
Pella
the Conqueror. It's okay. Spelled P-E-L-L-E, which, by the way, so many kids in Denmark are named that because this was a story that came out, I think, in 1910. And in fact, the kid who plays Pella, his name is Pella in real life.
Yes.
Because everybody just worships that story. So
and
what do you think?
The young Pella is featured stars. Yes, Pella Heaven. I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Vennegard. Alongside Max von Sydow, who we've seen in other films, and he plays his father.
He was in Hannah and her sisters.
Yes,
the Woody Allen film. I recognized him. I knew I saw him somewhere.
I did not. I didn't know him from that.
Yeah.
The protagonist is this 11-year-old boy who essentially is growing up. And leads a really hard life. And essentially, his father emigrates from Sweden to Denmark, where after they arrive on a boat, they try to find a place to stay, place to work. They end up in a barn as kind of laborers, and he basically offers himself as a Swedish immigrant, and the person who hires them from the docks says, yeah, I'll give you a place to stay. And they agree on
a
price.
In the barn, sleeping with chickens.
They agree on a price that includes the boy. So he is an indentured farmhand, and when they get to this farm way out, it is bleak. It's austere. It's in a very quintessentially Danish way. It is a remote and tough life.
Yeah.
So they're on the bottom rung there.
I didn't know.
They find out quickly.
There was so much hostility against Swedish immigrants in Denmark.
Yeah.
And I thought they pretty much got a lot. I know there's been a lot of contentiousness with invasions and things like that, but there really was. They were at, as you said, the bottom rung and had a lot to contend with. So basically, Pelle's father is illiterate. I guess there's not much of a future for him. He's an old guy, whereas Pelle has his whole life ahead of him and has to go through all this nonsense with school and bullies and things like that, being chased out onto the ice. And
his father keeps promising him that they'll get to have coffees in bed and they'll get their own place. They'll make their way.
Coffee in bed was his big thing.
That was his thing. Uh-huh. That was his way of saying that they're going to be all right. They're going to find their way through this, or they'll find a real home at some point. But this takes years. It drags out. And eventually a widower in the area.
Widow.
Widow. He's a widower.
Yeah, he's a widower.
And a woman who her husband perhaps was lost at sea becomes a possible out for him to get away from the farm. And that is a possibility, only to find her husband comes back. So that plan falls through. So there's a lot of tumult. In the end,
and I'm going to ruin it again, he goes his separate way. But I just thought it was a bit abrupt, and it didn't. They've only been there, I think, 2 years. And this kid is 11 years old, and he basically, they go to the middle of a field and say their goodbyes. And the only goodbye that the kid says to his father, who he's obviously extremely close to, is, thank you, goodbye. That's it. I don't think they even shook hands. Thank you, goodbye, that's all. And then he walks across this field, and I just wonder, what does this kid have now that he didn't have 2 years ago? Why does he suddenly have a bright future walking across a barren field at the end of the film? You know, it doesn't make any sense. Who's gonna hire a kid? What he doesn't have a fortune or anything like that. It's gonna be the same prejudice against Swedes. So I love the film, but that didn't make any sense to me.
Well, I think we're to assume he's learned the language a little bit. He's learned the ways of handling a dairy farm and you know, learned some trade and he nearly became.
So a 13-year-old kid who knows how to run a dairy farm, that's in demand, I guess. Maybe.
Hands down, a kid that grew up on a farm and did chores like, you know, hardcore every day, I would bet on them in any competition.
Also, what year was that? I had no idea what year. I know it wasn't this year. It was a long time ago. They didn't have electricity. I don't think they said anywhere. I would guess somewhere in the 1800s, right?
Late 1850s.
Okay.
It says in the late 1850s. The elderly emigrant lost Carlson. Yes. So it's,
there was supposed to be a sequel. They never made it. And they greatly regretted never making it. Anyway, that is...
It was very, very beautiful film and one of the most expensive epics.
Can't talk after the projector has been turned off. So now we are going to try something different that we have not done before, because we have been doing remote shows now for many, many months. We are going to try to establish communications with our friend Finn in the studio. And we're going to do this, but we're talking through what would you call this, Kyle? What we're using, what the technology that we're using to communicate with the station?
Irritating, annoying, cumbersome,
clever.
Oh, you want an answer, a serious answer. What are we talking through? We're listening. We're going to monitor the radio and try to have a conversation.
I know that. No, what are we using to communicate to the station?
We're using... What protocol? What program?
Oh,
we're using the Comrex. It's a remote broadcasting system.
Thank you.
That is renowned
in
radio land.
And our way of listening back to the station is through a speaker that is broadcasting the station. So we're delayed, I think, by about a half second or so.
Good for us.
But we should be able to hear our friend Finn. Finn, are you there?
Gentlemen, I'm here. How are you?
We are fine. We are fine. Now,
did I just knock a glass over on your end?
We didn't think about how to bring Finn up onto, I guess we have to make him very loud. Finn, how have you been? We haven't seen you since, I guess, March.
Well, I have to say, I do. I have been well. I go to my day job on a daily basis in the New York City subway system the entire time, and
I
get tested.
This is picking him up. I'm sorry, Finn. We didn't think this through.
You may have feedback if I go louder.
Okay, so but I'm wondering if this microphone can pick him up. You know what? Let's call him on the phone. Let's just do that.
You got
it. Bring the phone up.
Sure. What you mean by pick him up? Yeah.
Okay, we are talking to him on the speaker. Right, and how are people on the radio? Oh, wait, they can hear him on the radio.
Yeah, they can hear me, and we can all hear you.
I'm an idiot. I forgot that he's on the radio station as well. Okay, so I'm having trouble hearing you, Finn, but nobody else is. So I'm sorry. Just if you could answer my question again, how have you been?
I have been very well. I've been working every day, taking the subway to my day job every day through this entire time, and I get tested once a week, and due to my job, and yeah, I've been commuting out here most of the time. And how have you guys been? I miss your faces.
Well, yeah, we miss you so much. We miss the station. We just miss seeing people and interacting. We've been okay, you know, dealing with this situation. And
I'm sick of it.
Yeah, we're sick of it. We've been sick of it since week two. But
it was a lot easier to just stroll into a radio station, sit down, and talk.
Yeah.
But that's my grief.
Now, Finn, you are at the station. How are things? How are things getting there? How are things when you get there? We haven't been able to experience that.
Well, we keep everything sanitized and clean. We cover up our microphones with disposable covers for every live broadcast we do. And as of right now, of course, the campus at Stony Brook University, because it's in the week we are in, is completely vacant. But in general, I would have to say that the students at Stony Brook and my fellow DJs who I occasionally see have been masked and very, very safe.
Yeah, I have to say that makes all the difference, because when you see people making the effort, you realize that they're taking care of you, you're taking care of them. It's so ridiculous when I hear people debating these issues or coming up with their own science and saying that masks don't do any good. Of course, they make a huge difference. It's the people who have not been wearing masks that have gotten us to this dire state that we're
Correct.
In now. If we'd been doing this from the beginning, it wouldn't be nearly as bad. It you know, it doesn't matter on anything else. You know, if I disagree with somebody on 99 out of 100 issues, if they're making that effort to wear a mask and to just look out for their fellow beings, that, you know, I feel this warmth, I feel this pride, and none of the other stuff matters. As long as we're there taking care of each other, making sure that we get through this okay. And when I see that, and I you know, I've seen nothing but that at Stony Brook, that is something that really fills me with a good sense.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, I have to say, in New York City where I live, I also see most people, the vast majority of people, donning masks and being cautious, and as do I. And so it's quite a uplifting experience to see human beings not only looking out for themselves, of course, but also looking out for each other. And it's, you know, one of those things where people say masks don't work. Well, even if you think they don't work 100%, which nothing does, it's a how does it hurt? You know, it's moving in the right direction. People say they can't get used to wearing masks. I was like, how'd you get used to wearing pants? You know, so
exactly.
It's you get used to it. Yeah.
For people who say you can't tell me what to wear, you can tell people what to wear. You can tell them you got to wear pants.
That's right.
you got to do these basic things that society says is required, but it becomes so much more difficult when our own leaders don't accept this, and when they question the science and mock the scientists. And I just think how much we have lost because we put people like that in positions of authority. It's really sad.
Well, we've lost a lot. And, of course, the last 4 years have been disastrous. And I think the next few days are going to be even more disastrous in some ways. But, there's only so many tricks that can go on at this juncture. And hopefully there's light at the end of the tunnel here, light for science, light for humanity, and common sense. And it's just been all undermined this entire time, and just to for the ends of one individual. And it's a tragedy. And as you brought up in your show tonight, our own rep right here in Suffolk County, Lee Zeldin, with the with the vote to support the $2,000 checks, right? And you know, did Lee see the light, or is he just following his blind leader?
No, he's following his leader.
Yes, he certainly is.
Yeah. He says jump, and Lee says how high.
That's right. And that could go on for any number of years with Lee, based on him. So who knows what happens. And I think a few others, including a few Democrats that you were mentioning during the show.
A couple. There's always a couple.
I just want to briefly mention, you know, are you talking about Max von Sydow in the film that you're reviewing today? And he was, yes, in a Woody Allen movie. And, of course, Woody Allen no doubt cast him because Max von Sydow was in Ingmar Bergman films, his favorite. And however, Max von Sydow's greatest role, as we all know, was in Strange Brew. The film by the Mackenzie brothers of SCTV. He was the bad guy. Amazing. Yeah.
Wow. I got to see that. That sounds awesome.
You do. Make sure you have some brew around so you can tolerate it.
Wow. That sounds great. Well, Finn, it's been great talking, great hearing your voice again, and we look forward to seeing you. Hope you have a happy new year and that everybody there at the station is doing well.
Yeah, thank you, Kyle and Emmanuel. It's as I said, I love hearing your voices. I'm sitting here doing your show, listening to it, and it's fantastic. But I do miss seeing your mugs get in here at the last minute. So it's great.
Do we have time to go out with a quick outro?
Sure, go ahead.
I think you might like.
Let's hear it.
Have you heard of Hildegard Neff?
I have.
Of course you have. You've heard of everyone.
Well, go ahead. Let her rip.
All right, this is from an album that I think you really like, which you probably already have, called The In Crowds.
Let's hit it. Gentlemen, have a great new year.
All right, enjoy. See you later.
I came to the world on a cold winter's day. Sneezed 3 times, it must have been hay. My father was livid, he wanted a son. I took a look round and said to the nun, from here on it gets rough. At first I found I had little to do. They allowed me to grow a room with a view. But after a while they hit on a plan. It's time to start learning, the trouble began. From here on it got rough. I had a dream which I found very clever. I wanted to act. Mama said no, never. My father said out. I was already gone and followed the call. The show must go on. From here on it got rough. My talents were spotted, producers were proud, and gave me those parts where you stand in the crowd. When the star became ill, I stepped in like a shot, and someone from film signed me up on the spot. From here on it got rough. I played all the good parts and sometimes the bad, and sometimes a fig leaf was all that I had. And then Hollywood said it would certainly die if I didn't come soon, so I went, aye, aye, aye. From here on it got rough. But now I was famous, I'd made it at last. Came happily back to the scene of my past. I received a big prize, had my name in Who's Who. But after a flop, that name was taboo. From here on it got rough. First I was hurt, I thought it was wrong. Then somebody heard me singing a song. I told him I couldn't, but he said, yes, you can. So that's how this latest torment began. A change was overdue. From here it's rough on you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So now it is, of course, time for the revolution right here on WUSB Stony Brook. Thank you to Emmanuel and Kyle for kicking us off there. And let's see. Here we go. Here comes the thunder, baby. The thunder that starts the celebration for the end of 2020. Right here on WUSB Stony Brook, the last week of the freaking year 2020. Be glad when it's done. I think it officially ends on January 20th, 2020, but we'll 2021. We'll see what happens. But in the meanwhile, we're going to celebrate some birthdays. Marianne Faithful, Rick Danko, Jim Rita, Jesus Mary Chain. Stay tuned. Song written by Barry Reynolds and Marianne Faithful.